bet to show up at these 2026 elections, because we going in the wrong direction right now. With that being said, I appreciate all the people who called in. I believe Jerry Silver will be in next week. So have a blessed Sunday. I'm up out of here.
Celebrated throughout the month of June, LGBTQ Pride Month is a time to acknowledge the years of struggle and recognize the accomplishments in the continuing path toward equality for LGBTQ individuals. KPFK Radio celebrates the opportunity to wish a happy Pride Month to all.
Hi, this is Gloria Steinem, and you're listening to 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles, 112,000 watts of progressive free speech radio.
Good morning. It's 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and you're about to listen to a brand new episode of Beneath the Surface coming up with Susie Wiseman. Stay tuned, KPFK.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. On today's show, we turn to New York City, where Zohran Mamdani, Democratic Socialist, DSA member, and Queens Assembly member, has just won the Democratic primary for mayor in a stunning upset over former Governor Andrew Cuomo. Mamdani's campaign, grounded in rent freezes, public housing, fare free transit, universal child care, and dignity, was powered by volunteers, DSA, immigrant working class groups, movement politics, not billionaires or political machines. His victory is shaking the Democratic Party, thrilling progressives, and sending Wall Street into panic. Joining me to talk about what this means for New York, for democratic socialism, and for the future of the Democratic Party is Alan Minsky, Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America and longtime organizer and former program director here. He's argued that Mamdani's win is both the vindication of Bernie-era politics and a challenge to the party establishment to finally open its doors to the energy and vision of a new generation. We'll talk about all of that, the movement that got Mamdani here, what kind of mayor he might be, whether his victory is replicable across the country, and whether this is the beginning of a new chapter or a flashpoint in the struggle to remake the Democratic Party in our rigid two-party system. That's all ahead when our program returns in just a moment. And welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman, very pleased to have Alan with us. And we are discussing the stunning victory of Zohran Mamdani, a 33-year-old New York State Assembly member, a Democratic Socialist who won the mayoral primary in this historic upset over Andrew Cuomo, who was forced to resign in disgrace as governor in 2021 following sexual misconduct allegations. Cuomo outspent Mamdani by about 4-1, but couldn't match the enthusiasm for Mamdani, whose honest, broad-based, and visionary campaign won the day against the status quo and the ossified Democratic Party establishment. He's the first Muslim and South Asian nominee for mayor of New York, the first Democratic Socialist in generations to have a real shot at leading a major American city. His campaign grew from years of organizing among young progressive immigrants, working class, Arab and Muslim communities, long pushed to the party's margins, and he won across the city in nearly every constituency. Is this victory translatable across the country? What can we learn from this victory? Alan Minsky just returned from New York City today, where he was involved in the campaign and talking to people in the campaign. And he's here with his view of how Mamdani won, what it means for New York, the left, the future of the Democratic Party, and social democratic reforms across the country. Alan, welcome to the show. Before you come on, I just want to properly introduce you. Alan Minsky is the executive director of the Progressive Democrats of America, or PDA. Before joining PDA, Alan was KPFK's longest serving program director. He is also the producer of this show and still produces several podcasts, including mine, Jacobin Radio. He's written a series of books on American sports history and regularly publishes articles on politics and strategy for Truth Dig, Common Dreams, The Nation, and all kinds of outlets. And as I said, he was in New York, and his takeaway from that election is appearing now on Common Dreams. It's called Two Truths the Dems Should Take Away from Mamdani's Win. Well, with all of that, Alan, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. And of course, it's important to say at the top about Progressive Democrats of America, which I'm honored to be the executive director of, but was not the executive director until 2018, that Progressive Democrats of America was the organization that drafted Socialist Senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, to run for president in 2016 and to do so as a Democrat on both fronts, both him running and him running as a Democrat. PDA proved persuasive. And of course, what PDA organized to achieve transformed American politics and the American left. Zohran Mamdani himself says that he was inspired by the 2016 Bernie Sanders campaign to get involved in electoral politics in the way he has. And I also should say, I actually have been a member of DSA longer than I've been a member of PDA. love both organizations. I have a lot of love for DSA, and I'm incredibly proud as a DSA member out here in Southern California. And I know so many DSA members in New York that this election was won by Zohran Mamdani and by Democratic Socialists of America.
You know, that's a big, amazing accomplishment. And it is, as I, you know, sort of hinted in the introduction, a political earthquake as well. And you just, you know, reminded our listeners about PDA's role, the left's role in bringing the Bernie campaign. And Bernie has literally transformed politics. But the national following for Bernie among youth, among immigrants, among workers, all across the board, has basically created this, you know, fight within the Democratic Party who basically hates their left. And we'll get on to that. Mm-hmm. But Mamdani's surprise primary win against Cuomo sent shockwaves throughout the country, I would say, and the National Democratic Party. So, and he also did this, as I said in the introduction, where he was far outspent by, you know, the Democratic leadership and all of the billionaire backers. Now we see that Bill Ackman and others are going to throw their money to defeat him in November. But why is this win such a watershed moment, and how did it happen?
Well, first of all, it has to be said that Democratic Socialists of America, in their electoral campaigns and their great victories, have been concentrated in major cities. In particular, the Los Angeles City Council, I think, has three DSA members. It's only a 15-person council. Number of Chicago Board of Aldermen members are from DSA. It's a larger body. I believe that Zohran Mamdani was a part of a 8-person block on the New York State Assembly and also in the New York City Council of DSA members. So the victories have been concentrated in, obviously, I just cited the three largest cities in the country. There have been some victories elsewhere. Of course, Summer Lee famously was a DSA member, and she won in Pittsburgh, first in the State Assembly and then the U.S. Congress. Greg Kassar was in Austin, Texas. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, of course, back in New York City. So there's strength in DSA across the country. But for people who aren't familiar with DSA, which, you know, I know for your audience, almost everybody is, you know, when you get to the broad outlines of the electoral platform that DSA has, the overlap of the Bernie Sanders platform and obviously then the PDA platform is very, very, very almost one-to-one. I think there's certain things where DSA is stronger, and I think actually PDA probably matches them in those strengths. But, you know, in terms of practical public policy, domestic public policy measures, it's very similar to what the nation is now familiar with, the Sanders mm-hmm. platform. And, you know, it can be framed as a democratic socialist platform. Some people call it social democratic. And of course, it has a lot of resonance with New Deal era American politics as well. And of course, it's worth saying that the greatest, I think, mayor in the history of New York was a New Deal era mayor who was a Republican Party member and a socialist, Fiorella LaGuardia. And of course, some of the great mayors in the history of the United States, most notably in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, actually going through the McCarthy era, believe it or not, very successful and beloved mayors, the socialist mayors of Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
And in fact, I was going to ask you about this later, but why not now? In Milwaukee, it was the sewer socialists,
right,
as they were called, that fueled his win and his governance, right?
Well, for sure. And also, I think in some respects, I think that the name stuck in part because as they did continue winning, there were only a few of them, but they had long terms and sometimes they were interrupted by defeats. But they were there for quite a stretch of 40 odd years, I think it is. And it goes through the post-World War II era. So they're not stridently ideological in that period. They're very much about, the practical public operations of public services, et cetera. Of course, the important thing to understand about Zora Mandani's platform, and maybe, of course, significant differences therein and the Bernie Sanders platform, have to do with what you need to have as a platform in a major, obviously the largest and most densely populated city in the United States of America, New York City, and a federal, set of policy platforms. And obviously, the way that federal spending operates is quite in contrast with cities, let alone state spending. We all remember from the 1970s, those of us who are alive, and even though I was very young, I certainly remember where people who were buying up New York City bonds stopped buying them. And the city appealed to the federal government, and Gerald Ford said there was no help, and New York City was bankrupt. And so, that's not anything that the federal government has to face so long as they do continue to extend the debt limit, as we see. But also, just that's an artificial thing to do anyway. It's really the opportunity to use deficit spending, in other words, is much greater at the federal level. And so you can tackle things like universal single-payer health care as a proposal. And that's sort of outside the bounds of somebody who doesn't have control of a sovereign currency. I mean, you can try it at the state level. And of course, I applaud the initiatives at the state level. And right now, I think there's a very strong effort in Oregon. There is a significant effort in New York State to have universal single payer health care there. But while it'd be great if it happens, the risk of it being undercut by a budget deficit is so much greater than if it was at the federal level. I, of course, do support these single payer initiatives. I'm sure Zohran does. As ambitious as his healthcare platform was, it doesn't go that far as to propose that. And that the difference therein is because the difference between a federal policy capacity and a citywide capacity. Now, having said that, just looking forward to a prospective Zohran Mamdani mayorship in New York, the city has a massive, of course, city workforce. And it's an incredibly wealthy city. I mean, off the charts wealth in New York City, of course. And so there's great capacity there to adjust and readjust the policies, and the platform that he's putting forward on many, many fronts speak directly to the difficulties that the majority population in New York City experiences on a day in, day out level. And I think it's a visionary platform. And he's drawing on all sorts of great traditions of progressive urban governance, and bringing them home to bear, hopefully, in New York City. Obviously, he's not yet. This was the primary.
Yeah.
And it is worth noting. I know it's not everybody's most popular point among us on the left in America right now to mention that, of course, there have recently been some Republican mayors and conservative Democratic mayors of New York City. So the race is not won, but he's going to be very much the heavy favorite, especially with the incredibly unpopular and Trump-supported mayor running an independent candidacy, which should undercut any Republican candidacy. So, the betting odds, I think, are very good right now for Mamdani to win, and that we will see. I think what's open to him is a much more effort to have a set of pretty high-profile transformative policies. More so than the recent progressive mayor in Boston, which, Boston is actually a relatively small part of the Boston metro area. The city itself is about a quarter of the population. Chicago, which is about a third of the metro area, New York is about half is in within the city. So it's massive. It's 8 million people. Chicago's 3 million. Boston's, 700,000. While they have big tax bases, because it's where the corporate offices are for the most part, or they're concentrated in Boston and in the city of Chicago. You actually had a threat of corporate exit from Chicago when Brandon Johnson won, but also his set of policies, I don't think, were across the board as ambitious as what Zohran Mamdani has put forward on sort of issue after issue when it comes to grocery stores, setting up city grocery stores so the food is available without the profit margin element. Obviously, something that's really almost unique to hear about that. they do exist in certain places in the country. People don't know about them, and it's been sort of reintroduced as a concept through this campaign. And there's a number of issues like that. The free buses, though, that was in Boston. You have really him leaning in so heavily into the reality that there have been efforts to strengthen and maintain rent control, but they've largely failed. And he's adamant that he's going to pursue that and achieve it. And the people of New York want it. And very excited to see what he's going to do. Yeah.
This is great, Alan. You've just gone over a lot of the issues that made him so popular. And also, it has to be said, made him seem visionary, even though, you know, a lot of what he proposed, as you also said, is not so radical. And in fact, is the norm in a lot of other places around the world. Social democratic.
And by the way, I don't think we should go any further into this interview or dialogue without mentioning that he did something that I think there is an amazing appetite for among the American public. He was unwavering in his honesty.
Yeah.
In his honest assessment of the catastrophe in Gaza.
Right. This was absolutely key. And in New York City, that has more Jews than probably any other city in the world, he won over the huge Jewish constituency as well. So putting paid to this, you know, this sort of sentiment that's been manipulated around the country that, you know, to be critical of what's Netanyahu does makes you anti-Semitic. This is not the subject of our program, but everybody has said this about Mamdani, that he campaigned not with anger, and maybe not with joy, but with dignity, and promised dignity, a dignified life to every single constituent. And you know, Waleed Shaheed begins his article about this victory talking about the bodega strike in 2017, where after 9/11, and then again in the various periods in our more recent history when there was a Muslim ban, or when Muslims were swept up and put into, you know, detention centers, and that they were always pushed to the margins of the party, he listened to them and he talked to them and he talked about, you know, issues that matter to them as well. And I was just going to say that, you know, you've talked about some of the bread and butter issues that he won over so many people, and not just rent freeze and free transit, but also these public grocery stores, which we can go into in a little bit, but also really, really important, free childcare, is so economically wise. It frees up women to work. Mm-hmm. It grows the economy. I hate using that word, you know, like that. But everywhere that you have free childcare, you get growth and you get a much better life for all of the citizens. And this is a winning proposal. And we should also say that he won across New York in all of the boroughs, in places that you wouldn't have thought before.
Wow.
His platform resonated. And so that, you know, is an important question. And it sort of leads me, I just want to say one more thing, because I know you want to come in on that. But what does this mean for left strategy elsewhere? And I do want to talk about the movement, you know, that brought him in. I also want to just say one more thing. Free transit, free childcare, public housing is the norm in almost every social democratic city across the world. And New York City, like London now, are centers of finance and mass inequality, but they weren't like that always. And this all comes about in the Reagan and Thatcher era. And you mentioned New York City in the 70s when it was bankrupt. It had the free university system that educated so many people. Mm-hmm. These things all have to be said, that the platform may sound radical now, but it's standard in many parts of the world, and it echoes New York City's own past.
Yeah, no, even with the baby baskets, of course, which is a fantastic proposal. No, he addresses, of course, and you know, speaks to the cost of CCNY compared to what it once was. And so, you know, when you look at childcare, you look at housing, higher education, and healthcare, even though, of course, as we covered that already in terms of the capacity of the city government to address it, those are items that break households in America over and over and over again. Of course, the first one that a young family experiences is childcare. So it's just absolutely resonant. I want to move out to the way that this relates to the Bernie Sanders, Zohra Mamdani platform across the rest of the country. Of course, it's also worth noting before we leave New York City, you mentioned how much Andrew Cuomo outspent Zora Mandani, but a number of volunteer people working on the campaign, I think, was a little bit more than 4-1 for Zora over Andrew Cuomo.
I think it was probably
100 or 1,000 to 1. Yeah.
Right. Well, I just wanted to say, because this is the movement over the machine, and that literally here we see that Mamdani's victory was powered by massive grassroots operation that was led by DSA and progressive organizations. Here's what I saw recently in an article by Eric Blanc. 50,000 volunteers and 1.5 million doors were knocked, backed by DSA, youth activists, and unions, including AFSCME, UAW, and Teamsters, and contrasts with Cuomo's $25 million super PAC machine. So this is another lesson. We've been learning it over and over again in recent politics, that organizing versus big money, organizing wins.
Well, an amazing thing happened in this race in the last week as New York residents and voters learned more about Zora Mamdani and the campaign. Obviously, he started getting headlines once he closed in. It was a two-person race. He and Cuomo were the focal points of the debate. Bhaskar Sankara, a week before the election, did an analysis of the, if you look at the tabs on the polls, and he saw that Mamdani's base remained, actually, some to a degree, higher income New Yorkers and better educated, college-educated New Yorkers, and he was not doing as well as Cuomo with the multiracial working class. And by the time the election happened, that shifted, and I point to Ben Davis's article in The Guardian analyzing the data from the precincts, and in that short time, Mamdani, in fact, made up incredible ground in New York's working-class communities of color in particular. If you look at the map, you know, he still lost Staten Island. But yes, so he made up ground in, of course, a very, very important constituency for the progressive left, and something that was something of a sore spot for Bernie Sanders back in 2016 and 2020, actually, to say the least, which is how weakly Sanders consistently performed among Black voters, Black Democratic voters in 2016 and 2020. Bernie, of course, actually did very well among Latino voters in 2020 in particular. But Mamdani, as, again, communities of color, working class communities learned about him, the deeper you got and closer you got to the primary date, he gained a lot of voters. And that's a very, very important point, not just for New York City and the New York City Electoral Coalition for the Left, but it's important, too, for the country, I think, very important for the country, in part because, you know, Bernie Sanders did suffer continually weak results among Black working class voters and poor voters and Black voters in general, actually. Oh, the only subset of the Black vote that Bernie did well in was the youth vote. And I think what's very telling is that the degree to which this grassroots campaign really focused on working class communities of color, it really represents a lesson there. And of course, DSA has been exemplary in terms of its focus on working class communities of color, in terms of its public policy positions, its organizing and its activism in New York City. So that also goes to show that you just can't pop in to communities. You have to have a presence there as a progressive left, you know, integral and to come from the community itself. So yes, that was a important shift late in the race. All the more reason to be ever more excited about the results we see.
Now, just come in on one part of that issue, because you said at the very beginning something extraordinary about Mamdani's campaign was that he didn't compromise on pro-Palestinian solidarity and outrage or horror about, you know, what's being visited on Gaza. And that seems, you know, very important. But also, I think,
any politician in the world who articulates anything differently is either just an outright horrible person or they're gaslighting you. And they are consistently gaslighting you. It's of an atrocity that everybody in the world, if they just even are remotely honest themselves, sees right in front of them.
But I think you're exactly right. And what he did that was, I guess, indicative of the way he approached his whole campaign was to frame human Palestine solidarity in human rights language. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to talk about human rights and to talk about dignity. And that's something that, you know, is really core to those of us on the left, but often doesn't get expressed in the right way. And the other thing was, you know, the incredible generosity. So Brad Lander, who came in third and who has a great history of accomplishment and getting things done in New York City, it was a candidate in the race, and they appeared together and cross-endorsed each other. One hopes that he'll even invite Brad Lander into his administration to take on some kind of leading role. But that kind of partnership and that kind of generosity is not something you often see in politics, and is incredibly attractive. And I think, and I'm asking you as a question, whether or not that broadens support, perhaps among people who are not democratic socialists or that progressive, but are just liberal and like that, as a very nice counterpoint to the kind of hatred, politics of hate, that we see from the Republicans.
Absolutely. I think that's a very compelling part of the campaign. Also, of course, many people are making a lot about, you know, his charisma. I like to believe it's easier to be a charismatic politician when you're speaking honestly about the real needs and desires of the electorate, and you don't, you know, give some BS claim that these tiny incremental shifts that neoliberals promise and rarely even get to these days really amount to anything for the constituents. You know, Zohar Mamdani's message and his personal charisma were mutually reinforcing, in my opinion. Also, people who look at this and say, well, you know, Cuomo was a particularly vile candidate. Yeah, but he also has a massive name recognition that was what propelled him to such a massive lead. And so, you know, there were assets and deficits there in the public perception of that campaign. And also, by the way, when you're putting up such a reprehensible top line candidate, it speaks to the absolute poverty of the Democratic mainstream. Now, the article I wrote focused on the implications of this nationally.
Can I just frame that for one second? I know that's really where I want to go as a sort of overarching theme of this show, is whether or not this is replicable or duplicable or translatable, as you've said, across the country. And if so, how? And, you know, we could maybe ask various aspects about that. Why hasn't it happened regularly up until now? Is New York City specific? We also talked about its past in Milwaukee. Why aren't there a whole lot more AOCs around the country? Is her district so specific that maybe it doesn't translate into what other people can do? This is a really important point. And then that, where I hope you're going, is that this victory represents the rising Democratic electorate, which is multi-ethnic, immigrant-rooted, young, progressive. You know, this is the way the Democratic Party's base looks, but this is something that the ossified Democratic leadership tries very hard to push away.
Well, look, I think it very much vindicates, even though it's New York City, and some apologist for the centrist said, you know, no one's ever said, as New York City goes, so goes the country. But having said that, the issues faced by New Yorkers are faced, again, with a different texture, no doubt, but by people and working people all across the country. It certainly shows the massive attractiveness of the Bernie Sanders, I'll call it Sanders squad, Zohran Mamdani politics. And I have felt that since the 2016 election, if you look at American politics in the rearview mirror from before 2016, it was, of course, a longstanding cliche that there was, quote unquote, a bipartisan consensus on foreign policy. If you just go look at the Romney-Obama debate, the first debate on domestic economic policy in 2012, you can really see that there was a hell of a lot of a bipartisan consensus on economics. Okay. And
to mention and that Obamacare was Romney care in Massachusetts.
There you go. Absolutely. And after 2016, you then had three political tendencies vying for power in the two-party system. You had the absolute reactionary Republican Party, proto-fascist and now fully fascist, the MAGA movement. You had in the middle the neoliberal center running from the Romney wing of the Republican Party through the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party. And then you had the Sanders progressive left. And I think there, given that Trump, who breaks, is something of a break with neoliberalism, but also that can be overstated because really the policies that are going to really be drawn out here, in some senses, are just a further consolidation of neoliberalism. Certainly you see the cutting of social services, austerity in effect, plus more tax breaks for the wealthy. So it's on steroids. But what that's all about ultimately in terms of public policy and democracy is the consolidation of rule by the elites and the termination of public influence on governmental policy through the suffocation of democracy and the consolidation of oligarchic gains. And then in the middle, you have, yes, they're constitutionalists, but, you know, they so completely, the neoliberals have such contempt for the interests of, and by the way, they're now largely in the Democratic Party. I mean, of course, there are neoliberal policy positions in the Republican Party still, of course, but the neoliberal Democrats are today's political conservatives. They want to conserve the economic status quo of the past 40, 45 years.
And as you've written elsewhere, are completely tied to the donors.
Absolutely.
If not being them themselves.
Absolutely. And now, having said that, the one element of their conservatism we have to remain not fully alienated from them with is they do support the constitutional democratic republic, which the fascists are trying to defeat. And so we can't be so tin-eared and adamant that we break off a coalition post-primaries to defeat the Republicans. But we have to wrest control of the Democratic Party from the neoliberals who continue to control it. So how much does this impact that? Well, okay, it shows the incredible lure of the left progressive economic agenda. And it shows that the best organized group of people involved in American electoral politics right now are the DSA-driven campaigns in most particularly New York, but Chicago and Los Angeles. The idea that a political party fighting against fascism would alienate such an efficient and brilliant group of people working within the Democratic Party. Zohran Mamdani just won the Democratic primary. Let's not lose sight of that, folks. Okay.
Exactly.
I mean, and I in the article I wrote in Common Dreams, I arrive at the point that now is the time to consider a caucus of socialists, but knowing that that's going to get not embraced by the Democratic establishment, a caucus of socialists who outside, looking inside, strategize to achieve influence inside and transformation of the Democratic Party so that it becomes the people's party that we need. And that is not going to happen by the Democrats ceasing to be recalcitrant on these issues, the establishment Democrats. And the big problem we face, so yes, it's a great victory. I'm now going to go to why it doesn't break the mold, okay? And this is important to recognize. First of all, the Democratic Party, and I know that Ken Martin, the new head of the DNC, is getting a lot of criticism from a lot of different directions. And I do, of course, believe he should lead and the DNC should lead in a way that makes it clear that they're going to really, truly embrace and try to bring about the embracing of left progressives and democratic socialists into the Democratic Party from the DNC. But the truth is basically that the Democratic Party is 50 different parties. Each state has its own parameters of regulations. There's no uniform structure for a Democratic Party in any state. And the experience of the Bernie Sanders progressives, and PDA was one of the organizations that led on this, so we know it, to our core, we had mass entryism of tens of thousands of Bernie Sanders supporters into the Democratic Party in 2017. But then after that, in state after state after state, and almost universally, probably about 10 states, there were exceptions, and actually progressives still more or less have the upper hand in about six states in the country. Yeah. But in the other 44 states, and even in those six, the establishment, they did not welcome the influx of the Sanders progressives in the party.
I mean, this is where you see that they really hate their base. The Republicans, I say this over and over again, year after year, the Republicans fear their base and the Democrats hate theirs.
Yeah.
But as you've just said, and I just want to echo it and let you elaborate even more, Megan Day has an article today and that came out in Jacobin where she basically says, you know, that the Democratic Party is just a collection of liberal politicians, mostly old, but there's no sort of center there. There's no there, as you said.
Yeah,
but at the same time, there's the gerontocracy. And this is a very potent point where they say, you know, look, Dianne Feinstein stayed too long. Ruth Bader Ginsburg stayed too long. Joe Biden, you know, stayed too long. All of that. But that to me is not really, I mean, that's all true. But maybe you could bring in this recent fight with, you know, David Hogue to say, is this just a generational fight or what is it?
Right. And Hogue, who I was generally sympathetic towards, but even if Hogue in entering into his vice presidential candidacy wasn't putting forward, I mean, I supported Jim Zogby first and foremost as vice chair of the DNC and, you know, the kind of just out and out clear progressive measures speaking to the issues, I mean, money and politics, of course, central to it, and clear strategies born from his experience to bring mass entryism into the party and to address the money that Zogby put forward. But David Hogue, as this evolved in the public, I mean, you just couldn't have more of a tenure again than the way that the Democratic Party establishment approached this. I mean, it was ridiculous. I mean, they need young people to participate in the Democratic Party. And the broad stroke message that was sent out was, well, we don't really want young people in the Democratic Party. And that's what came across.
But this is really pertinent to the point that you're making about, and that I asked about, if this is translatable around the country, this kind of a victory that is really the fruit of, you know, grassroots organizing, but also honesty, simplicity. The message about affordability, all of those things.
I am so thrilled, and we are all so thrilled. And I love New York, and I love Fiorella LaGuardia, and I love the victory by Zohra Mamdani. And I love all the, you know, the DSA's members who are in the state assembly from Metro New York and New York. Obviously, there were two squad members from New York, and now there are only one. But, you know, there's a great radical tradition there. The rest of the country... we need these politics to also be victorious. So what I think this shows is that the type of organization that DSA is about and puts into practice and achieves needs to be applied across the country. Now, by PDA, by DSA, by mass membership organizations, and they have to approach each of the 49 states, counties, cities, and whatever the constituency could be, but in particular, to be able to have a critical mass inside the Democratic Party through a number of mechanisms to transform it so that the balance of the party is about the policies of Bernie Sanders and Zohra Mamdani. So what we call for in PDA, we used to just emphasize something called an inside-outside strategy, which is that you go into the party, that's going inside. Once you're inside, you make sure that the voices of social movements and unions come into the party. So you provide a conduit for social movements to come into the party. I now propose an outside, inside, outside strategy. So bracketing the first outside, and what I mean by that, is that we need to have organizations like PDA and DSA have a strategic approach to achieving that transformation in the Democratic Party, okay? We have to be aware that there are barriers to achieving that. And by the way, Susie, if you want to know how very, very difficult they will be to overcome, the metaphor that comes to mind is silver bullet that comes to mind. I'll talk about that in a second, which is presidential elections, okay? But outside of presidential elections, the barriers to achieving at the federal level the policies that we want to be to win and then to become public policy in the United States. So we have like a New Deal type transformation. Right now in the U.S. Senate, among the sitting U.S. senators, we are so far away from that.
Well, that if you don't mind, I'd want to. There's several things I'd like to bring in about that, because, you know, people have always said that the Democratic Party is the graveyard of social movements, that this isn't a new strategy. But it is a different situation.
Right.
It's because right now it's not, you know, the Demopublicans and the Republicrats. It's the Democratic Party, let's call it neoliberal / establishment with a progressive base and a full on fascist, racist party, anti-immigrant party. And here's a question about that, because you're talking about inside outside strategy. But, you know, we live in California and we have this memory of Prop 187 that made the Republican Party toxic for generations. That was the one that was, you know, basically going to get rid of the immigrants. And there was a lot of issues about it that we don't have to repeat here. But right now, Trump's big, ugly bill, or big, beautiful bill, as he calls it, which is so reactionary and has so much opposition, is actually has opposition even among Republicans, lots of them, and is getting challenged here, there, and everywhere. But I think the question is if they do get it through, will that also make the Republican toxic for a generation, as happened in California? Because this is so extreme and hurts the base of even the Republican Party.
If the neoliberal Democrats remain ascendant in the Democratic Party, and again, they have the critical wedge for control of it, and particularly at the high legislative level, because in the Senate right now, there are about 8 progressives and 35 neoliberal conservative Democrats. And that means they support the maintenance of an economic social contract that the American people loathe. And if they win out over the left progressives in the Democratic Party, DSA, PDA, Justice Democrats, the degree to which the Working Families Party is involved in the Democratic Party, all of these forces, and left unions, of course, that if they win out over them, yes, they may win an election. And this is exactly the kind of election the consultants want, 50.1 to 49.9, because the money will keep pouring in.
And that's the other big issue, of course.
Tons of money. But you are seeding all change in a country and a society that wants change, loathes the current status quo, to the fascists.
Yeah.
And so we do need an alliance if it's necessary, and I'm guessing it is, because I don't think we can predictably believe in the next few election cycles we're going to win over the Republican component of the Republican voters right now. That has to be a priority goal, along with motivating and having people in all of the multiracial working class communities in the country believe that the Democratic Party is really going to pursue public policies that will lift their lives into a prosperous middle class, which is a very attainable goal within a country that generates as much wealth as the United States of America. But if we don't achieve that transformation, I think it is setting the table. And as you can see with Trump and these absolute anti-democratic fascist oligarchs from Silicon Valley, who aren't stupid guys, and they're all guys, and they are working to shut down our democracy, to consolidate the gains of the wealth and power inequalities of our society. And that is the fire that the neoliberal Democrats are playing with, because they are suffocating the politics that the base of the Democratic Party wants. And they have to stop it. They have to. And, you know, and look, I say this in the spirit of saying, to look at a state like Washington, might have the most progressive voting base in the country, and you have two neoliberal senators. And I've heard nobody say, and nobody believes, that Murrier Cantwell will be challenged or could possibly be challenged anytime soon. So, you know, go across the whole slate of 35 neoliberal Democrats in the U.S. Senate. How do you get those guys removed? And to go back to the outside-inside strategy, we have to be as tactically wise and smart and organized and disciplined. And these formations generally don't exist across the country, except in embryonic form where they're DSA chapters and that are involved in electoral politics, as we know some of them aren't, and PDA chapters, to look at the Democratic Party in this outside inside way, build up a base that is just trying to go into the party and to win primaries and to transform the party internally, so that you create a party that is a people's party. And that's going to take a strategic acumen. But we have one massive asset, the most important asset of all: the public is with us. And I think that's what Mamdani's election shows. On the one hand, what a very disciplined and inspired group of activists can achieve. That's lesson one. And lesson two is that our policies are embraced by millions upon millions of people across the country. Bernie Sanders is once again the most popular politician in the country,
along with AOC. I think it has to be said that their anti-oligarchy drive throughout the country, and especially in red states, has been incredibly important.
Mm-hmm.
But Alan, you're just, you know, I really like what you're saying. And essentially, it's the way to organize that the left must organize inside and outside to push the party to majoritarian goals. And I think you're also saying that there should probably be a socialist caucus within, you know, the Democratic Party. But, you know, one of the major problems in American politics is one, this two-party rigid structure. And after that, probably even before that, is the role of money in politics, which, you know, makes it very, very, very difficult. And maybe this campaign shows the way that that can be broken, as Bernie Sanders did in many ways. Corporate donations don't outweigh the grassroots support and small donations, but also just that energy. So you're talking about inside Congress and the Senate, these victories have been in districts, but also cities. So what happened in a big city like New York and other cities possibly? How much does that translate to what you're talking about that has to be done to, you know, to take over the Democratic Party, and provide that kind of a challenge?
Well, first of all, Bernie Sanders and Joe Ramondani are two perfect examples. Everybody who knows anything about them and about American politics knows they are not the Democratic Party that is receiving public opinion ratings of in the 20s. That is for Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer, right? And for what it's worth, the failure of the Biden-Harris campaigns.
Yeah.
So it's for mainstream Democrats. So, you know, having a very different brand. I mean, look, we promote a PDA. We co-authored a Rural New Deal with the Rural Urban Bridge Initiative's Anthony Flaccavento. And it is a set of economic policies that would address the needs of people in small town and rural America in the way that I think they want their economic reality to be addressed. And we think it could have a huge influence in changing the dynamics of certainly many statewide elections. Contempt for the Democratic Party across rural and small town America is very, very high. So that's tough to overcome maybe in certain congressional districts, but it certainly can swing a whole set of states. And again, as for going to Murray and Cantwell, I do want to make this point. The silver bullet is the presidential election. And if we do get in a situation where we have a president who is poised to win the Democratic nomination like Bernie almost was twice, again, we have to make part of the play because senators are very, very hard to dislodge. And of course, they do have 6-year terms as opposed to every House member being elected every 2 years. So they're there for a while. They're a conservative impediment to change. But we have to make a case to these people. And then in making that case, we open up a space for them being challenged within their states if they remain recalcitrant. Because they have to understand that what we're proposing, and maybe this is the best place to end, Susie, this is logical common sense for the welfare of the country and the planet. Don't forget, the progressive left is the only force in American society that has a sane pro-international law, human rights, foreign policy. That is a sane approach to the prison industrial complex and the mass incarceration of Americans and the defunding of education. And we're the only group that has a sane approach that has a hard scientific backstop that is we're in line with the science on the climate emergency. The neoliberal Democrats, forget about it. They're going to burn the planet down just, you know, maybe a couple years less fast than the Trump people are. And of course, the Trump people are outrageous on it, fully outrageous on it. So, and you know, this summer is already showing what that's all about.
Yeah.
And fires and everything. So look, we have the right policies.
And also the fact that Trump is trying to dismantle every one of these, you know, clean energy infrastructure factories that Biden, you know, put through in the Inflation Reduction Act, all in red states, which will cut out more jobs, but just in this vindictive, you know, way to get rid of every single thing that Biden did. And before that, Obama. So, you know,
if we do eliminate big money from Democratic primaries, but the Democratic Party is open to taking big money in the competition with Republicans, which might end up being is, you know, just trying to look into a crystal ball. If we get real headway with getting money out of the primaries, it might be a little more difficult to have the Democratic base agree to have all big money out. Though I think that's an argument to be made because we'd be very popular with the public if one party doesn't take any big money. But the, you know, all of the green energy companies should only be giving to progressives, let alone the neoliberal Democrats, and of course not the Republicans. And that could be a big capital base support. But that's a very pragmatic approach. And I don't want to leave, though, without also bringing up what's been going on here in Los Angeles. And, and how beautiful Mamdani's campaign was around the rights of immigrant workers, too. Again, I think it's certainly in New York City, and I know there's a lot of propaganda polluting the minds of Americans who watch Fox News and things like that around, you know, who immigrants are in our society. And it's tough because if we were talking to just 2 weeks ago, there's no way we wouldn't have been highlighting that tremendously. The nature of the hyperventilated news cycle in the Trump era. And of course, now we're talking about Mamdani's great victory. But what's been happening in Los Angeles is one of the most frightening, certainly the most frightening thing I've ever seen, unless maybe you take, obviously, from American history, slavery, the genocide of indigenous people. But in American society in my lifetime, maybe the, you know, the crime bill, post-1994 or five crime bill, growth of the prison industrial complex. But what's happening here is insane. And it takes your breath away. I just returned here from being in the East for 12 days. This has to end. And I think, again, what we have to do is not, you know, tippy-toe around things in any way, shape, or form. Do like Mamdani. Be very clear as day. Don't, you know, the neoliberal Democrats are going to just have no backbone on, you know, protecting families and the people who generate so much wealth in our society. And they're such, make such a beautiful contribution to Southern California and the entire country. And we just have to take that on square on and have people understand that, obviously we need a pathway to citizenship, and we should not be doing this to any families anywhere in the country or anywhere in the world. There's one thing I didn't bring up that I wish I had just in the volleys around what this all means. But the thing is just, the American polity, I think, is at the cusp of recognizing that there is one model that produces a generalized, prosperous, modern technological economy. And it was the model that was in an ad hoc way sort of arrived at by Franklin Delano Roosevelt's administration. It was arrived at by social democratic and democratic socialist forces in Western Europe. And there are about 20 or so odd prosperous liberal, quote unquote, liberal democracies in the world. And 19 of them have really maintained to a significantly greater degree than the United States this social democratic, democratic social contract. Wealth inequality in those countries is nothing like it is in the United States of America. And the happiness, health, education of the populations is doing much, much better in the United States of America. And I think people are realizing that the United States, much more free market, individualistic, sort of social contract or social organization is not working for the population, and that what is available to the people in Germany and Western Europe and South Korea and Japan and Australia and Canada is much more agreeable. And I think that with the world being smaller, with international communications being what they are, and everybody picking up on information from all over the world through their devices they hold in their hands, the American public is ready to embrace a set of programs that will bring America into alignment with the rest of the world. And those are the politics of DSA and of the Bernie Sanders campaign and of PDA.
But I think, Alan, you know, and I'll just say, because I know that we're coming toward the end of our time, but you've just laid out a very good way that, you know, Mamdani's campaign can be a template for a national progressive transformation, but also highlighting the way that Trump's and, let's call it, Miller's anti-immigrant hysteria and racist policies show that they have, and hatred of California, by the way, show that they have no compunction and would not flinch at all in telling the National Guard to fire directly on demonstrators. We saw some of that, and we saw the police essentially protecting ICE rather than the demonstrators standing in between. And there's a lot of work to be done on this because people are horrified by the ICE raids that are not taking away criminals, but workers. And, you know, as one after another small business collapses, as people, you know, start to realize how important these essential workers are to our lives, you know, I don't know what it's going to mean. But, you know, as you mentioned, we have to stress this. And I think before we go away, we might just say that even though Mamdani won the primary, November is the election, and we're going to see a backlash. We're going to see a lot of money poured in with Cuomo and Adams, and you know, and they're going to try to smear him. It hasn't worked so far. He's been a sort of model of how to campaign, but there's going to be Islamophobic attacks. There's going to be smears and billionaire outrages we're already seeing. So this is, you know, I guess a question about how we should all prepare for that. And I'm talking nationwide, but also in New York, for that kind of ugliness that we may see. And do you think he'll prevail?
I do think he'll prevail. And I think that in New York City now, and in fact, the way to turn the table on these kinds of attacks is to, again, advocate for the policies that most address the interests of the majority of the population in their day-to-day life. And then in terms of, you know, hot button issues that are less kitchen table issues, so to speak, bread and butter issues, just unflinchingly, you know, don't start moderating, you know, your honest feelings and put them forward, because they're the correct instincts. And I think people are sick of these attack ads. And, you know, it's maybe in the context of all that we're talking about, it's a bit of a petty example, but I thought it was telling that In Other Lands won the best documentary in the Academy Awards, where, you know, the general sentiment going into the last Academy Awards was that, you know, you couldn't do anything that was pro-Palestinian, but the bullying from the pro-Zionist lobbying forces in Hollywood and across the country, people
attacks
hate
on universities. I mean,
yeah, people hate this stuff. And everybody, people hate having the Gestapo in town. People hate the attacks on, you know, people who are honest activists and practicing free speech, and they're picked up by the Gestapo and disappeared, you know. And I think if we're just clear about it and straightforward, I don't think that the sort of repugnant variant of the neoliberal center that New York has put forward is going to make a comeback. And I think it's also the way that we can best defeat Trump, is that kind of honesty and forthrightness. And again, I just want to end, though, again, on clarifying the necessity of the Democratic Party as an instrument to defeat fascism, and the essential necessity of defeating fascism and its dysfunction can be overcome and transformed by the progressive left, running all the way from, you know, people who are call themselves progressives to people who call themselves socialists, by organizing and recognizing it's an instrument. It's also an operation that needs to be transformed. We know how to transform it now. We have to overcome the barriers to making that transformation of the Democratic Party, because we're inside the two-party system. But there is this little beautiful component of our two-party system. So, because when you get the nomination of one of the two parties, you're this close to winning state power.
Yeah.
Right?
And as we see with what Trump did.
And I think that's a beautiful place to end a Jacobin interview. So, and a Beneath the Surface interview.
Thank you so much, Alan Minsky. I can't thank you enough for all of your insights. And just for the listeners, go look for his article. Essentially, Lessons for New York. The Democratic Party needs to welcome Democratic Socialists and embrace the policies America wants. That's not the title that you'll see on Common Dreams, but just look for Alan Minsky's name. And Alan, thank you so much. And I should just say, Alan is also Executive Director of PDA, Progressive Democrats of America. And you should probably write to them and maybe to your local DSA chapter to see what you can do, because we're going to need everybody out there in the time ahead.
PDAmerica.org, PDAmerica.org/join.
Thanks so much, Alan. That's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Alan Minsky. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gota, and Osman Flamenco in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. You can also listen to an extended version of this program on Jacobin Radio, available wherever you listen to your podcast. Information and programs are on our Facebook page. That's Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. And you've been listening to Beneath Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. Stay tuned now for Ian Masters and Background Briefing. I'm Susie Wiseman.
To engage in any activity
that shall contribute
to a lasting understanding
between nations and between the individuals of all nations,
races, creeds, and colors.
To gather and disseminate information
on the causes of conflict
between any and all of such groups,
and through any and all means
compatible with the purposes of this corporation,
to promote the study of political and economic problems
and of the causes of religious, philosophical,
and racial antagonisms.
That is our mission.